Good evening. It's Wednesday, October 30th, 2019, and it's 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Liana. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, a colonel testifies he raised concerns about the Ukraine and President Trump. Defying White House orders, an Army officer serving with President Donald Trump's National Security Council testified to impeachment investigators yesterday that he twice raised concerns over the administration's push to have Ukraine investigate Democrats and Joe Biden. Alexander Vindman, a lieutenant colonel who served in Iraq and later as a diplomat, is the first official to testify who actually heard Trump's July 25 call with new Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. He reported his concerns to the NSC's lead counsel, he said in his prepared remarks. What does this do to the impeachment narrative, and will testimony of this nature have a resonating impact with the electorate even if the Senate does not vote to remove or censure? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. You hear him here every morning on Radio Sputnik as the co-host of Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan. Lee Stranahan, as always, Lee, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So let's just kind of start with your general take on what you heard coming from Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Well, first off, I wish we had all heard more in the sense that, you know, we have his preliminary statement, but as you know, these are being done behind closed doors right now. The Democrats are about to change that and start to have a more open process. But right now, this is sort of somewhere between I'll call it a kangaroo star chamber. It's between a kangaroo court and some sort of secret thing, but I'll tell you, this is very concerning in general. One of the premises, and I have criticism for the Republicans on this as well, but I don't see anybody pointing out that the president sets foreign policy. And in fact, when I hear news reports about this, and when I hear them repeating claims that people were concerned that Rudy Giuliani, for instance, was having a sort of, you know, second shadow foreign policy. Rudy Giuliani was acting at the behest of the president. It's the president's foreign policy. But that whole premise is predicated on something that is the underlying and very scary premise at the base of this, which is the president, Donald Trump in this case, doesn't really run foreign policy. The foreign policy is, in fact, run by what we'll call the deep state. You can call it the persistent state. It's these people, and Vindman's one of them, these people who stick around from administration to administration, no matter, you know, John Bolton being another one, and Vindman's a guy who, you know, connected to Bolton as well. These people in the military and the CIA and these other groups, they, in fact, really do run foreign policy. And they are as pissed off as they can be that Trump is trying to have any say in it. And you can see that very specifically with Bolton. Bolton is clearly Fiona Hill, who also testified last week, was a Bolton aide, worked at the Brookings Institute for 20 years, which was headed up at the same time it was being headed up by Strobe Talbot, who is Bill Clinton's Oxford roommate. And that's significant because Strobe Talbot is one of the people at the heart of the real Trump-Russia story. He was being briefed by Christopher Steele at the time. So these same people who've been pushing the Russiagate narrative, they've made it very, very clear what their goal is. They don't want the U.S. to have any sort of better relationship with Russia. That is what they're upset about. And nobody, including the Republicans, not one politician I can name, is questioning that premise at all.
Would you consider Henry Kissinger to be one of those holdover deep state people?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Kissinger is as deep state as they can get on this. And by the way, was friends with a guy named Lloyd Shearer. Lloyd Shearer was the editor of Parade magazine. His son, Cody Shearer, has known the Clintons for over 50 years. he married Strobe Talbot, who I just mentioned, sister, and therefore Strobe knew him well. Kissinger is as old school as you can get,
right,
and is connected to this little cabal as you can get.
So Vindman says that he was concerned by the call, that he didn't think it was proper to demand that a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen, and he was worried about the implications for the U.S. government's support of Ukraine. Now, he also testifies that the accounting of the call that the president says is correct and accurate, Vindman says it is, in fact, not correct and accurate, and that some very important words were left out and replaced by ellipses. And does that cause you any concern?
No. And part of the reason is Zelensky has made his position on this whole issue very clear. But again, I have no problem with the president conducting foreign policy as a matter of principle. These are people who do not want the president. Again, I got to make it very clear. Nobody is questioning this premise. This was all about destroying foreign policy towards Russia. And by the way, it's worked. As much as you hear from everybody in the media, you know, except Sputnik, and that Donald Trump is Putin's puppet and everybody else, every other insult we hear about that. In fact, here's the reality. The Trump administration has issued harsher, more substantive, has done more to harm relationships with Russia than any previous administration. The sanctions the Trump administration has put on Russia are worse than Obama put on there. And again, I think this is clearly despite Trump. In other words, it's not, I think Trump came in wanting a better relationship with Russia. By the way, I think the same way that Obama, I really believe this.
I was just going to say that President Obama wanted the same thing.
Yes, I believe, and everything I've said applies exactly to the same people with both Obama and Trump. They wanted to make sure that's what this Ukraine thing is about. This guy, Vindman, he is as deep state as you can get.
I'm sorry, just let me jump in and ask you this. Wasn't the term Obama used reset? Wasn't that the term that he said he wanted to reset the relationship with Putin? And a whole lot of people scream and yelled about his term reset. Wasn't that the term he used?
Yep. No, you're exactly right.
Okay.
I think what we're learning here is that the president doesn't really run things. I mean, that's really what we're learning. When it comes to foreign policy,
mm-hmm.
They'll let the president go out and do, you know, they let Obama get the health care stuff he was campaigning on, sort of. But even that, they modified it heavily from what he ran on, right?
Even he modified it because he ran away from the public option when the health care lobbyists let him know, under no certain terms, we will not sit idly by and allow you to do this. And he flipped on that quicker than my dog rolls over to get his stomach rubbed.
Yeah, well, no, I complained about the same thing at the time. I voted for Obama in 2008, and I wrote about that at the time. But I think it's so clear the pressure that presidents have. It's mm-hmm. easy to go, well, he's the president. He
right.
runs things.
No, he doesn't.
No, not really. Not really.
He's a functionary of the United States government and, as some would call it, the deep state.
Yep. And I think in the case of Obama, you know, it's fair to say his personal style is different than Donald Trump's.
Right.
Now.
But the outcome is basically the same.
But the outcome has been the same. And look at what's had to happen. Why was Bolton in there? Because obviously a number of people, including my old boss,
pressured him to take him.
A complete 180 on Steve Bannon is a very bad guy, not for the reasons he gets criticized for in the press, but for the stuff that they'll never criticize him for. He is secretly a player working for these big interests. That's who he is. They never criticize him for that. They call him all sorts of names that in my personal experience aren't true, but he's a bad guy. He's the one who brought Bolton in. He is the person, and I've commented on this. I said this 2 years ago, actually. I said when I used to host the Breitbart radio show over at SiriusXM, they let me choose my own guests the way we do on my show Fault Lines now, the way you do, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they told me every Thursday is Bolton Day. You have to have John Bolton on Thursday.
Oh, God. How nauseating is that?
Well, agreed. But at the time, that was the... I didn't really think anything of it.
Right.
But as soon as I thought about it, I'm like, that was really weird that they made that rule that that's Bolton Day. And the reason they did that is they were trying to soften the ground. The Breitbart audience is not in favor of regime change wars. It really, you know, the average, I'm not saying nobody, I'm saying the average person, mm-hmm. when Trump was talking about we need to stop, it might be for different reasons than somebody on the left, but, you know, it's about we're getting involved in these foreign entanglements. They cost us a lot of money. But it's the same instinct. These are a mess, right? These regime change wars are a mess, and we don't want to be involved in them. Well, the reason Bannon was doing that was to soften the ground for Bolton. He recommended Bolton came in, and of course Trump had to get rid of him. And he was trying to stir up things in Venezuela. He was trying to stir up things. We almost got us into a hot war with Iran. Let's be really clear. And Trump had to stop it. So I'm, you know, very empathetic for presidents right now. And I think people need to be really aware that your problem here is not Donald Trump. And your problem here is not, if you're on the right, Barack Obama. Your problem here is the people who stay from administration to administration. And they are flexing their muscle and saying, we run things. And that's what everything we're seeing on Capitol Hill is about, flexing muscle from the deep state.
Let me ask you this. If I accept your premise, doesn't the administration let the members of the administration that could support the president's argument go and testify before Congress?
Here's the problem. The president finds himself at this point surrounded by two groups of people, traitors and, for lack of a better word, grifters. I would put Rudy Giuliani in the latter category. Rudy Giuliani, he likes money. And, you know, both he and Bolton are the supporters of the MEK, this fake jihadist cult, Marxist jihadist cult group that they want to see there. But if you look at, so it's interesting that Bolton is going after Giuliani. That's part of what came out yesterday, is that Bolton
right.
was really wanting to take out Giuliani. Now, that's very interesting, but you got to understand the reason that they support the MEK is different. Rudy doesn't think too deep about these issues. He just collects a paycheck.
Right.
Bolton
is more of an ideologue.
That's right. And, mm-hmm. and so what you're seeing is, and the president is getting his information filtered through Fox News, which is absolutely against him.
So what you're telling me, though, Lee, is that Donald Trump is in way, way, way over his head. Because if he's getting his information filtered through Fox News, and if he can't figure out the grifters from the, what was the first term you used?
The ideologues.
If he can't figure out the grifters from the thieves, he has no business being there. Other than the fact he was duly elected. Well, and we can argue that point. But you get my point. Dude has no business being there because he has no worldview. He has no vision. He's a transactional in everything for him. And I'm not just casually lobbing bombs at the president. I mean, I'm what you're telling me is he's incompetent.
No, that's not what I'm telling you. I'm telling you our system is so corrupt that I cannot think of anyone better in the current circumstances. And I will point out that Obama. I'm saying the same thing about Obama. If you look at let's look at what happened with Barack Obama. The first thing they did after putting Rahm Emanuel in as his chief of staff is he took the most dangerous politician in America, Hillary Clinton.
I agree with you.
And she was put in. Now, what else happened?
Wait a minute, Lee. He took the person whose vote on the Iraq war
yes.
that he used as the fundamental premise to support his foreign policy chops, to say, I didn't do what she voted to do. I'm smarter than she is. Vote for me. He took her, and we know why. He took her, put her as his Secretary of State, and then allowed right. her to convince him to double down on the stupidity of Iraq, and it was called Libya.
And
I got you on that. But going back to Donald Trump, what you're telling me is he's incompetent.
No, I'm saying something very different. Not to over-intellectualize this, but as a philosopher once said, don't hate the player, hate the game. And this is
but
the
I got that. Don't hate the player, hate the game. But you got to know when the players can't play.
I would argue that I really believe this. I think you'd have to name somebody who you think would handle this better. And
you.
Right now,
I'll vote for you.
I'll take it. I'll take it. No, no.
There's another saying. Once you know how the game gets played, then you got to learn how to play the game.
No, I agree, and I'll put it like this. I think Trump sending Bolton packing was significant. Now the problem is,
I'd agree.
He is literally Donald Trump has promoted a book twice in the past 3 or 4 days called Exonerated by this guy from Fox News named Ben Bongino. It is a complete pack of lies, but it's not a pack of lies in a way that Donald Trump understands. Or, frankly, most people understand. It is the standard Fox News thing. You can see this, again, this is about stopping any president from having a relationship with Russia that is anything but antagonistic. This is what they want, the worst relationship with Russia possible.
Okay.
And they want it through NATO for a variety of reasons. But even Tulsi. I'm a Tulsi Gabbard fan at this point. I don't agree.
I got to get out in 30. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I was just going to say, even Tulsi, when it comes to issues like Ukraine, I don't see any politician, not one single one of them, questioning the fundamental premise, which is our foreign policy in Ukraine is insane and designed just to antagonize Russia. Nobody's saying that.
I got to get out. Lee Stranahan, you will hear him every morning right here on Radio Sputnik as the co-host of Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan. Lee, you are so gracious when we call. I truly, truly appreciate it. Thank you so much and look forward to having you back.
Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Thanks, man. All right. Hey, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Senators grill Boeing CEO over plane involved in two crashes. Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg faced withering questions from senators yesterday and today about two crashes of the Boeing 737 MAX jets and whether the company concealed information about a critical flight system. Quote, "We have made mistakes and we've got some things wrong," Muilenburg conceded. Some members of the Senate Commerce Committee cut Muilenburg off when they believed he was failing to answer their questions about a key flight control system implicated in both crashes. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is the president of Mackey International, an aviation consulting firm specializing in aviation safety, risk management, accident investigation, air carrier certification, and safety compliance audits. He is Keith Mackey. Keith, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
So let's start with kind of the general question, your overall thoughts on these two hearings and what, if anything, really came out of them?
Well, they're interesting. Certainly, the CEO of Boeing took a lot of heat, had a lot of difficult questions to answer. Some of them were answered well, and some of them were not. So we're still, I think, missing some information. But the bottom line is that Boeing is able to fix the problem by redesigning the system as it should have been designed originally. And I believe when the airplane is returned to service, it will be safe. Now, the problem is getting someone to approve that return to service. The FAA is going to have to sign off on it. And after all the information we've gotten over these months, it's going to be very difficult to get individuals to put their neck on the line and say, yeah, it's safe, even if it is.
You specialize in aviation safety, risk management, accident investigation, air carrier certification. One of the issues that I've heard about plaguing this process has been the fact that the FAA is understaffed and that the FAA, to a great degree, outsourced their air carrier certification to the carriers themselves. And so is that going to be a problem in this particular instance?
Well, in this instance, we're not talking about an air carrier. We're talking about a manufacturer.
Okay.
And although the FAA does air carrier certifications, this is an engineering certification.
Gotcha. Thank you for that clarity.
And it's done by an engineering representative. And you are correct. The FAA is always understaffed. Consequently, it's very hard in the industry to pin them down to a timetable. For example, if you call me and ask me if I could get you what we call an air taxi certificate to operate a small aircraft commercially or a jet, I'd say it will take years to do it, not because it will take me that long to do my part of it, but to get the FAA to have the time to respond and the manpower to respond takes a long time. So there's part of the problem. And the other issue is they don't have sufficient staff to know all the details of every aircraft that's manufactured. So when you bring someone in that doesn't work for Boeing, that doesn't have a history of knowing how Boeing does things, it's very difficult for that person to step up and make a critical decision as to whether something's correct or not. And the solution in the industry has always been to trust people to a certain extent and designate them to certify that their product meets the standards. And in this case, there's certainly some doubt about it, and that's part of the problem of resolving this, to get someone to buy off and say, yes, it's all correct now. The reality is it didn't take very long to fix the problem. They had to do three things. They had to use both angle of attack sensors instead of one so that a single failure couldn't cause the problem. They had to have the system activate only one time rather than repeatedly activating and putting more and more trim in there. And they had to limit the force that the system could put in so the pilot could, just by holding the control yoke back, control the airplane. And before the airplane returns to service, those three changes will be made in the MCAS system. And I think it'll be fine.
You've said this a couple of times, getting someone to sign off. I'm still not quite understanding, who would that someone be? Would that someone be an FAA official, or would that someone be a third-party contractor that the government has contracted with to manage this process? Is it a combination of them? Who is this someone to sign off?
Well, actually, in the case of Boeing, they're not using third parties. They're using their own personnel to go in there and interface with Boeing's engineers.
Okay.
And the reality is, before this is presented to the FAA, Boeing's going to have to sign off on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the FAA, whoever they designate to do this, whoever this task, and it'll probably be a team of people, they'll have to agree that everything's good to go. And frankly, I thought the airplane had been flying for months now. This is just kind of going around in a holding pattern. Nobody seems to be doing very much. And as time passes, more little tidbits leak out, like emails between personnel at Boeing that add some interest to the situation because they would indicate that perhaps Boeing had some knowledge that the system may not have performed correctly and didn't deal with it. Now, that's not for certain, but that's the implication that you get from reading these text messages and emails. So this is no doubt slowing the process down.
According to Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut, Boeing successfully lobbied regulators to keep any explanation of the system, the MCAS system, from pilot manuals and training. After the crashes, the company tried to blame the pilots. Quote, "Those pilots never had a chance," according to Blumenthal. "Passengers never had a chance. They were flying in coffins as a result of Boeing deciding that it was going to conceal MCAS from the pilots," end quote. Is that Richard Blumenthal engaging in hyperbole, Or is there really some serious basis to Blumenthal's statement?
Well, let's examine that bit by bit.
Mm-hmm.
In Boeing's opinion, if the system operated the way they thought it would, it would never be visible to the pilots. There'd be nothing they could do about it. It would just take place. It would make one input. It would correct the situation. And the pilots wouldn't even know that it happened. Now, when Boeing produces manuals, they try to put the pertinent information in there and nothing else. Now, years ago, when we got our training manuals, we had to be able to describe every single system on that airplane down to the last detail. And the reality was all that information wasn't really necessary. So now the tendency in the industry is to concentrate the training on what the pilots will actually use. So I don't think that Boeing was actually hiding anything. And had the system been properly designed and functioned the way it will now, probably the information would not have been important. Now, the pilots, on the other hand, really reacted improperly in both accident sequences. They weren't well trained. Each seemed to have some problems. They never reduced the power. They just let the airplane go faster and faster. And consequently, when the stabilizer trim started to run away, even though you can very easily trim it manually, because they let the speed of the aircraft get so high, it's like driving down the highway at 70 miles an hour and trying to open your car door. You can't do it. So they didn't have the physical strength to do it. Now, had they just observed the indications they had of the stabilizer trim wheel running away and reduced the power, everything would have been fine. They could have come around and landed the airplane. So the pilots were poorly trained and did not react properly to the emergency. So you can't just take the pilots out of the equation and say they did everything properly, because they didn't. So it's hard to blame just one person here. It's a combination. In fact, Indonesia just released its final report.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few things I take exception with it. But generally, I think they've done a pretty fair job. And they said there are 9 events that formed a chain. And if you broke any of the links of this chain, the accident would not have happened. So Boeing had a problem. The FAA had a problem. Lion Air had a problem with their maintenance, a major problem. The company that had overhauled the replacement angle of attack sensor didn't do it properly, and the pilots weren't trained properly and didn't react properly. But other than that, everything went fine.
I've talked to other American pilots about this issue, and to a person, they've all talked about training, and they've said that there's a reason that this problem did not happen in the United States and that it happened in foreign countries, and that is because of the training of American pilots, and that American pilots, in spite of these instructions not being in the Boeing manual, because of other training that they have received their entire careers, that American pilots would have known what to do. Does that get to your point about pilot error?
Absolutely. This was simply a runaway stabilizer. And we've trained the same system as been all the Boeing airplanes way back to the 707. If the motor, the electrical motor runs away, you turn the cutout switches, you take the handles on the wheels and you trim it manually. And every time we give someone a simulator check, we always simulate this runaway stabilizer. And it takes just a few seconds. They recognize it immediately, take the corrective action, and then we restore the system and we go on to the next problem. Now, over there, what they would do is they'd hire a new pilot, put him through their company ground training for several months, and then give him flight training, minimal amount of flight training, in something like a Cessna. And then they go in the simulator. And in the simulator, there'd be 2 of them in each pilot seat, an instructor. But my understanding is they'd have 4 other people standing up in the back of the simulator observing. And when this runaway stabilizer occurred, let's just say it was on lesson 3, they all knew exactly when it was going to happen, and they'd see what they did. And so they may have never had any real hands-on training doing it. So the lack of these things, their inability to recall memory items and that, this is important. And, you know, you can't blame them as individuals. They were just poorly trained and put into a situation that they couldn't handle by the company and the regulatory authorities in the country that they were operating.
Muhlenberg told senators that Boeing is in the final stages of updating flight software to improve safety by adding redundancy, tying MCAS to a second sensor and second computer at all times, and making the system's availability to push a plane's nose down less powerful. You've touched on some of these in your earlier explanations. Will this solve the problem?
Absolutely. And I'm hopeful that I'll get a chance to try it out.
You are a brave soul.
No, I wouldn't have any problem with it at all. I'm sure that it'll work. I'd like to fly the simulator and just be able to demonstrate it.
Mm-hmm.
The situation is that they've probably had this fix in place for almost a year now, because it didn't take them very long, I don't think, after the Lion Air crash to put the pieces together and figure out what likely happened. And then they realized that they created a problem. Within a few days, they'd issued what we call an emergency airworthiness directive that clearly explained that if you encounter this situation, these are the things that you should do. And the Ethiopian pilots had copies of this bulletin, but yet they didn't seem to understand or follow the procedures on it. So I'm not sure what you can do.
Let me ask you two more marketing-related questions. One, over the last, I'd say, 2 weeks, and I don't know if you have noticed this, I've seen a lot of Airbus commercials. I don't remember prior to 2 weeks ago ever seeing an Airbus commercial. Have you noticed this, and is that because Airbus sees a weakness in Boeing here? Because of this 737 MAX issue, and Airbus is now trying to market its standing in the American market?
Well, to answer your direct question, no, I haven't noticed that.
Okay.
But let's discuss Airbus and Boeing as they relate to one another. Airbus really doesn't need to do any marketing because there's so many people trying to order the A320 series airplane that they're backed up for many, many months. So actually getting that airplane would be very difficult. You have to understand that Airbus has taken a completely different approach to building these airplanes than Boeing has. Airbus, about 20 years ago, realized, hey, there's a lot of countries in the world that are developing, that are going to need air transportation, that do not have militaries with a lot of pilots coming out. They don't have civilian pilot forces they can draw from. They're going to have to train their own pilots. And these people aren't going to have a whole lot of flying experience. So we're going to build an airplane that's pilot-proof. We're going to automate it to the level that it'll be really hard for the pilot to mess up. And that's what's happened with the A320 series. You can't stall the airplane. You can't spin the airplane. You can only do a certain degree of bank, and the airplane stops you. So the airplane prevents you from doing things that would affect you in another type of aircraft. Now, if I were to teach you to fly in an Airbus, you couldn't fly another aircraft because you wouldn't have the experience at recovering from stalls and doing spins and things like this that you would have if you trained in a normal, even a light airplane. Now, Boeing, historically, has relied on pilots rather than automation to be the backup. As time's gone on, they've added a little more and a little more automation. But when you do this, you're doing it at the expense of having the pilots actually get hand-flying experience, where they actually manipulate the controls and learn to fly the airplane well and build up the skill levels. And going forward, this is going to be a major problem. It is in developing countries now, and more it's going to be in the U.S. because we're teaching our even our airline pilots to use the automation as much as possible, not to make manual landings unless the weather's bad. That's not good. You can either be really good at operating the automation or really good at flying the airplane, but it's hard to have both skills. So there's the problem going forward.
And I've also been reading that in the very, very near future, there's going to be an international pilot shortage, and that could exacerbate the very problem that you just articulated. Final question, and this is just in your humble opinion. Let's just assume that next week, the 737 MAX gets blessed, all problems are solved, and the plane is released and considered airworthy, and now it's back ready to fly. Can Boeing recover from this from a marketing perspective? Or is the flying public going to get to the airport and say, I am not getting on that airplane?
Well, I think you ask a very good question. And in my opinion, what's going to have to happen is there's a lot of people, after all this publicity, that are not going to get on that airplane. So what the airlines are going to have to do is say, okay, the 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock flight to Los Angeles
are free.
Are going to be on a MAX 8. But the 9 o'clock and 11 will be on a standard airplane. And so you'll know what kind of airplane you're going to be on before you get to the airport, rather than making a reservation,
right,
getting out to the gate and saying, hey, there's a MAX there, I'm not going. So this is going to be a problem. Now, after they fly it for 6 months, people will begin to forget when there's no more instances, and perhaps we'll get back to normal. But I think it's going to be difficult to get people back on the airplane, particularly with all the bad publicity.
Keith Mackey, president of Mackey International. It's an aviation consulting firm specializing in aviation safety, risk management, accident investigation, air carrier certification, and safety compliance audits. Keith, as always, thank you for your time. You are always so gracious when we call. We greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome, Dr. Leon.
Thanks, man. All right, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. U.S. slowdown deepens as economic growth slips to a 1.9% pace in the third quarter. The U.S. economy cooled over the summer, growing at a 1.9% annualized pace from July through September, the latest sign that the slowdown is deepening. The data released today by the Commerce Department came as economists anticipated slightly weaker growth following President Trump's decision to dramatically expand his trade war with China. That decision in early August spooked business leaders and deterred them from making major investments during a period of such uncertainty. What does all this really mean? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the forthcoming book, and I say just about here, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, as always, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
So I know the book is due to be released very shortly. When will people be actually able to put their hands on The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump?
Well, they can get it immediately from my blog, jackrasmus.com, or from the publisher, Clarity Press, next week on Amazon.
All right. Looking forward to it, and we'll have you on to talk about it most definitely. So consumer spending continues to power the economy. Are consumers spending cash or are they using credit is one question. But business investment has now contracted for six straight months, falling 3% in the third quarter. That's the biggest drop since the end of 2015. What's going on with the cooling off? And again, are consumers are spending, but are they spending cash or are they using credit?
Well, the first thing you got to realize is this 1.9% GDP is probably going to go lower. That's just the preliminary GDP. The first revision comes out in about a month, and that's always the most accurate, and that always has the most change. And I'm predicting about 1.7%, which is what the stagnant Obama economy was for 6 years. In other words, after a multi-trillion-dollar tax cut that was supposed to boost investment and jobs passed in January 19, 2018 under Trump, now we got six consecutive months of decline, contraction of business investment. Partly it's due to the trade war, and partly it's due to the general more secular long-term trends going on after 10 years of the business cycle. It's not all trade war, and that's going to continue. If you look at the U.S. economy, there are four sectors that determine growth in GDP. One is business investment. That's, as you said, is contracting now for 6 months, and it's going to get worse. The other major area is what's called construction. In other words, commercial property construction, apartments, and the residences. Well, commercial property and apartments are in free fall in terms of growth. All we got is a little bit of growth because the interest rates have declined a little in the household residential area. So that's on net negative as well. Business investment is negative as well. The trade war is negative. You know, after 15 months of trade war, we have still the highest deficits, monthly trade deficits we've ever had, nearly $60 billion. That's like $700 billion a year. So that's negative. Government spending, there's some growth there. But the only thing that's keeping it up is consumption, which is two-thirds of the economy. But if you look at the recent figures, data that's come out on retail sales, which is the biggest part of consumption, that now is stagnant and going to decline. The growth you got from consumption, and it's declining, has to do with jobs. And has to do with wage increases, but there's really no wage increases going on for middle America, for the median wages. It's kind of all at the top. And the job numbers are half of what they were last year. Important thing is going to be, what are the job numbers this coming Friday? And people may get a shock. If not this, then the next month. Although the only thing holding the job numbers up is this tens of thousands of hirees here for the census, the government census. Mm-hmm. So it's actually even worse, softer. And if we see the jobs go down and without any real wage increases, the only thing that holds consumption up is credit, is debt. And of course, that's at record levels.
So to my initial question about consumer spending, cash or credit, the answer is primarily credit.
Primarily credit, yeah. And at the top, because the top 10% are doing pretty good,
Right.
People in tech, people in the professions, people in healthcare, they're doing okay. But the bottom 90% is not doing okay. And the lower you go in what's called the wage structure there, at the median and below, people are getting jobs, but they're mostly part-time temp, second and third jobs with low pay. So that's why wages aren't really growing. And, the GDP number is really not really accurate, because it's what we call real GDP adjusted for inflation, and inflation is lower than it really is. In other words, they're indicating inflation that's low. It's really higher than that, particularly if you're at median levels, and the higher the inflation rate, the lower the real GDP. Well, they keep the inflation rate very low so that they boost the GDP. But if you counted real inflation, your GDP would be about 1% now. I think that's really about where GDP growth is. It's really accurately about 1% for most people at the median income level. And that's near stagnation.
As we move closer to the holidays, will you or are you anticipating on the consumption side a dramatic uptick in consumer spending, and again, probably on the credit side of the ledger, as a result of people buying for the holidays?
Well, that's a mixed picture, hard to figure out, except maybe one indicator is online sales. And you've got, companies, big companies like Amazon, who are forecasting a drop in their revenue and their profits, which kind of suggests that they are reading into this a not very robust holiday season consumer spending picture. Other than that, it's hard to tell yet. A lot will depend on what the job figures are, this month and next month, because if the job figures are very weak, then consumers are going to pull in their pocketbooks.
And those job figures will be from July through September. They are not going to be reflective of the temporary hiring that businesses are going to be engaged in for the holidays.
Yes, except they've probably hired most of those temporaries right now.
Okay.
So, you know, it's kind of what it is what it is right now. Because, you know, they start selling in September, October now, very early. So they've hired those people already, and they start laying off in December. Another factor that may whack consumer spending is we're now going to see the tariffs from the Trump-China trade war began to hit here in November and December. And it looks like Trump isn't going to take the tariffs off of this last round, which is really impacts consumer goods. So we're going to see higher inflation, actually. It may not get reported, but higher inflation, and that will cut into consumer spending as well. In other words, there's no bright spot for consumer spending, which is the only thing holding up the economy at this date. And there are some indications, you know, that we're teetering on the brink, even with consumer spending. And if that goes south, you know, weakens, then clearly we're going to be in a recession because all the other cylinders of the economy, business spending, construction, so forth, are not firing.
I'm glad you straightened out those jobs, the holiday hiring, because I thought those jobs would be reflected starting in October, but I'm glad that you straightened that out to be August and September. So slow growth abroad and problems at big employers such as Boeing and GM have also contributed to this drag on growth. Let's talk just quickly about these two companies in particular, Boeing and General Motors. We know that Boeing is continuing to have problems as it relates to the Boeing MAX, and those planes are continued to be grounded. Nobody knows when, if ever, they're going to be back in the air. So Boeing is taking a huge hit. But I really want to just to quickly, for a moment, focus on GM, because they just, the UAW and GM agreed to to end the strike. The workers, nearly 48,000 of them, returned to work this past Saturday. But the reports are that this strike cost GM nearly $2 billion in lost production, and it cost employees nearly $1 billion in lost wages. That's simple math, $3 billion just from GM alone.
Yeah, and that's not factored into the current GDP numbers of 1.9% accurate. That's, you know, make a note of that. But, you know, what's going to happen at GM, like all the auto companies, they're in a funk. Auto sales have peaked and they're declining, and they're going to decline even more in the coming months. Plus, in this settlement with GM, if you read it close, GM got away with the right to close plants.
That's
right?
That's the next thing I wanted to get to, so yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the union got some big money up front in bonuses. You know, the GM bought with short-term lump sum and ratification bonuses, they bought that contract, in other words. You know, they threw enough money at the workers that they're going to take the money and run. But GM is going to recoup a lot of that money that it's paid because they're going to close plants, and that means less wages that they're going to pay, right? And the slowdown means there's going to be layoffs, less wages they're going to pay. So GM, you know, they talk about, oh, it lost $2 billion. No. GM's going to make up at least $1 billion of that in subsequent years of this contract.
But just in terms of the immediate impact, and the reason I threw that number out of the $2 billion, in terms of the immediate impact on GM, that $2 billion, that's still an ugly number.
Yeah, it's not a positive number, and that means GDP is probably going to accelerate the closing of its plants and the layoffs, which are going to start coming next year. So that will impact consumption because, you know, the auto sector is more than just 48,000 GM workers. It affects all kinds of suppliers and everything. You know, you're talking maybe 1 million workers here, and that's going to impact consumption as well, particularly in those key states where you have a lot of the auto plants.
And in talking about the auto plants and factories, one of the big losses that the UAW suffered in this negotiation had to do with moving car production from Mexico back to Ohio. The fate of the Lordstown, Ohio plant, which produced the Chevy Cruze, UAW was trying to get that plant reopened. GM said no, much to the dismay of President Trump, because he really was hoping to be able to declare that GM reopening that Lordstown plant would have validated his claim of bringing jobs back to the country.
Yeah, well, you know, Trump is, as far as bringing jobs back, a lot of smoke and no fire, right? He talks the talk and makes it look like he's doing something about it, but he could have done something about that. He could have leaned on GM to get them to do that. But, of course, he's not really going to do that. That's a lot of public consumption, you know, for his political base to bring the jobs back. You know, look, the UAW failed to achieve very much, if anything, about job security and plant closures. You know, GM negotiators, as I said, were very clever. They threw a lot of money up front at the workers to get a ratification. But, you know, the workers are going to pay for it with their jobs, because there isn't that much job security. As far as Lordstown, you know, they talk about, you know, some far-fetched idea of some other new company coming in and building electric batteries and so forth. But
right.
That's just talk. There's nothing really there. You know, Lordstown is done. It's cooked. And the other plants are going to follow. By the way, GM, of the three big auto companies, is the one that has most plants offshore. You know, so if anything, they should have brought some of it back. But, you know, they're not going to do that. And the, you know, existing up for ratification NAFTA 2.0 or USMCA, whatever they want to call it, you know, there's no provisions in that to bring jobs back to the U.S. None at all.
And just a final point on the Lordstown plant and the battery factory, even if that is to open, they've gone from about 1,400 workers to only a few hundred that would be at the Lordstown plant. And I understand that the wages would be much lower as well. So that's not even a Pyrrhic victory, or maybe you might want to call it a Pyrrhic victory.
It's still mostly talk.
Right.
You know,
gotcha.
And another element that they didn't achieve very much, I think, was on the temp workers. You know, an entry level temporary worker doesn't even get $15 an hour. You know, and they have more and more of those working in the auto industry over the last decade, and they got a little token improvement that if you're a temp for 3 years. Which is an oxymoron, because if you're working there 3 years, how can you be a temp? But yes, if you're a temp and you get about half of what the regular hourly pay is, you are on track to maybe become a regular employee. You know, but only those with 3 years seniority or more have even a chance of getting out of that indentureship called temporary work status. So they'll just hire more temps. You know. That's another way that they can undercut the wages they've agreed to pay.
Lower wages, less benefits, the company wins all the way around. Final point I wanted to get to with you as we're running out of time here. The Fed is expected to cut the rate for a third time. Talk to us about where the Fed is today. They're supposed to announce a rate cut.
Well, they did announce it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 0.25%. But look, you know, 0.25%. It's not going to generate any investment and any jobs this late in the business cycle with the trade war and all the other uncertainties. It's going to have absolutely no effect whatsoever on real production, real investment, real jobs. It'll give a boost a little bit, but it doesn't even look like that today to the stock market. So, you know, why is the Fed doing this? You know, it'll minuscule cuts that it will have absolutely no effect on the real economy. You know, maybe a little bit of housing. But that's about it. Why are they doing that? Well, because Trump wants them to lower their interest rates to protect the value of the dollar. In other words, to bring the dollar down in value. So U.S. multinational companies producing offshore can repatriate their profits at a higher profit rate when they exchange, you know, the pesos for the dollars. This is all about subsidizing U.S. multinational offshore companies, when they repatriate their money. It has nothing to do with stimulating the economy. It's all about subsidizing offshore corporate profits by lowering the interest rate, which lowers the value of the dollar, which allows them to convert more pesos, for example, into dollars.
And I think it's very important to wrap this up for people to understand, because a lot of folks would be scratching their head saying, well, wait a minute, Dr. Rasmus, cheaper money, companies want cheaper money. But the companies are pulling back because of economic uncertainty as it relates to the trade war with China and with other countries. So cheaper money is not an inducement to invest when your concern is trade war. Is that correct?
Well, yes, that's true as far as the trade war is concerned. Look, the business investment is the function, the result of a number of variables, not just the cost of money. Lowering the cost of money, the interest rate, by a simple little 0.25% is not going to improve the profitability expectations. You know, expectations of profitability are driven by a lot of factors, and the cost of money is a very small right now element in that total investment decision function. So, it's not going to have any effect whatsoever. What has the bigger effect is the uncertainty of the trade war, you know, the uncertainty of where the economy is going, looking globally at, Europe in recession, Japan almost there, looking at banking problems in India, in Europe, looking at financial instability in Latin America.
And Brexit. Brexit doesn't help.
Brexit, yeah.
That doesn't help.
Well, that's why one reason why Europe is in the recession now, because of Brexit, or Germany at least, and several other countries.
Let me stop you there. Dr. Jack Rasmus, author of what we were calling the forthcoming book, but it's now available, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, Jack, thank you so much for your time.
Always glad to be here.
Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out!